Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Mary O'Brien, a Physicians for a National Health Program, who takes a critical look at the health care reform legislation now being debated by Congress. Holly Sklar, Senior Policy Advisor with the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign, who talks about the coming increase in the U.S. minimum wage and her group's effort to establish a national living wage. And Christopher H. Pyle, Professor of Politics at Mount Holyoke College and author, who discusses the choices facing Attorney General Eric Holder and the nation on prosecuting Bush administration officials who authorized torture. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The leading human rights activist in Chechnya, Natalia Estemirova, was kidnapped outside her apartment in Grozny on July the 15th and killed soon afterwards. Estemirova ran the Chechnyan office of the Russian human rights group Memorial and exposed serious abuses by the Russian security services. She was a fierce critic of current Chechnyan president Ramzan Kadyrov. Memorial blamed President Kadyrov for the death of the respected human rights activist. Estemirova was a close associate of murdered journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who was shot outside her apartment in Moscow in 2006. According to Memorial staffers, in a March 2008 meeting, President Kadyrov yelled at Estemirova and pointedly asked her where she lived and how old her daughter was. She was also told to stop visiting police stations and prosecutors on behalf of families of the disappeared and murdered. Fearing for her safety, Estemirova briefly moved to London to work for Human Rights Watch, but returned to Chechnya to continue her human rights investigations. One after another, critics of President Kadyrov have been killed. These include Politkovskaya, human rights lawyer Stanislav Markelov, and former Chechnyan commander Sulim Yamadeyev, who was murdered in Dubai in March. Civil rights activists, in a report to the United Nations, claim the Bush administration's war on terror expanded opportunities for racial profiling by federal, state, and local police agencies. Among the programs cited by the American Civil Liberties Union and the Rights Working Group was a federal initiative called Operation Frontline, designed to disrupt potential terrorism during the months leading up to the 2004 presidential election. Foreign nationals from predominantly Muslim countries were over 1,200 times more likely to be questioned by officials from this program than people from other countries. Nobody questioned in Operation Frontline was ever convicted of a crime. In late June, the ACLU and Rights Working Group submitted comments to the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination. The groups responded to a January submission by the outgoing Bush administration that defended its policies relating to racial profiling. The body reviews compliance with the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which the United States ratified in 1994. The two groups criticized the Bush administration for its reliance on a 2003 policy paper that banned racial profiling while exempting important categories like religion and religious appearance. It also failed to deal with the broad exemption given to state and local police agencies who are handling a growing caseload of immigrant enforcement work. Political reports, the American Conservative Union, or ACU, offered to back Federal Express in a bitter legislative fight over union rules in exchange for a payment of nearly $3 million for grassroots mobilization activities. Among the services offered were op-ed articles by ACU Chairman David Keene, targeted email blasts, and radio ads in battleground districts. FedEx rejected the ACU deal, and soon afterwards Keene backed FedEx rival United Parcel Service in the dispute. Other conservative activists like Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform also backed UPS. The June 30th letter to FedEx from the ACU, obtained by Politico, is evidence of a long-running pay-for-play practice amongst interest groups in Washington, D.C. These lobbies appear to be willing to take sides in legislative battle when the price is right. FedEx's Murray Lane told Politico, Clearly, the American Conservative Union shopped around their beliefs and UPS bought. FedEx and UPS are fighting over a provision passed by the House of Representatives requiring package shippers to negotiate union contracts by individual locations, which FedEx insists will hurt its business. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
As a candidate, Senator Barack Obama campaigned for the presidency, pledging to reform the failing U.S. healthcare system. Now, 6 months into his administration, President Obama is pushing Congress to pass initial reform bills before the summer recess begins on August 8th. However, Republicans, conservative Democrats in both the House and Senate, as well as healthcare and insurance industry lobbyists, have called for more time to debate the final shape of legislation and how funds will be raised to pay the $1 trillion costs of the leading plans. Bills passed in the House maintain the primary role of private insurance companies, require all individuals to purchase health insurance, and all employers to provide it. The poor would get subsidies to buy health coverage, and insurance companies would be prevented from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. President Obama and Democratic leaders support adding a public health insurance option to compete with private insurance providers. Early on, congressional leaders took the single-payer option for revamping the U.S. healthcare system out of the debate, removing a model that has succeeded in cutting costs in most other industrialized nations around the world. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Mary O'Brien, a member of the faculty at Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York City. O'Brien, a spokesperson with the group Physicians for a National Health Program, takes a critical look at the health care reform legislation now being debated by Congress.
Well, single payer is still being largely excluded from the discussion, despite the fact that the majority of Americans in surveys support a publicly funded single-payer program and understand that it's the most cost-effective way to provide health care. It's still not being looked at seriously by the Senate Finance Committee, but it is being looked at a little bit more in Congress. Representative Weiner is adding on a H.R. 676, which is the bill that John Conyers has proposed for single-payer, adding it on to the House Tri-Committee bill. It's unlikely that it will pass, but at least it brings up the issue that single-payer really needs a fair hearing.
Dr. O'Brien, maybe you can assess for our listeners the broad outlines of what's being proposed by these various congressional committees, mostly keeping private insurance intact, but adding on a so-called public option. The costs look to be about $1 trillion over 10 years. What do you think of these plans that are being hammered out in these various committees?
I don't think they're true health care reform. I think that the Congress has really caved into the power of the private insurance companies. We know that the private insurance companies consume about 30% of every health care dollar. So to really look at providing health care reform while still keeping them in the picture is going to continue to expand health care costs. One of the suggestions that was looked at as a compromise was this issue of the public option, which initially was going to be a public program which would be analogous to Medicare in that it would be funded progressively through taxes, it would be open to anyone, it would be big enough that it would be able to negotiate for better drug prices, things like that, and it could probably honestly compete with the private insurance companies. However, it's really been somewhat eviscerated, and what's being proposed is not entirely clear at this point, but would be quite limited and would be more like private insurance companies. People would have to pay a premium for it. The public option would run similarly to private insurance companies. Americans would not have free choice of deciding on either keeping their employer-based insurance or moving to the public option. In general, if they have employer-based insurance, they would not be eligible for the public option. So almost from the beginning, there's been, to my mind, much too much compromise and not enough look at the final prize. It seems to me that the Congress has not yet defined what do they actually want for health care. Do they believe that all Americans have the right to health care and that we should develop a program that will give all Americans comprehensive health care, which would move us in a very different direction from where we're going now? Or do they believe that the status quo of health care being considered a commodity, like buying a TV or a car, that if you can afford it, you'll get it? That seems to me more of what's happening now. I don't see the current plans saving us much money. I think we're going to continue to have unsustainable health care costs. I think many more people will be put onto public programs like Medicaid, which are increasingly unsustainable for the states, which are suffering enormously from the drop in revenues and the increased number of people on public insurance. So I think basically we're not getting what we need in health care reform. And the concern is that this is such a great opportunity, and it comes at such an important economic moment that if we don't get a good plan now, it may be quite a while before we have the option to do this again.
What is it that you and the Physicians for National Health Program are advocating to do right now? Are you hoping that a plan, any plan, even a flawed plan, will pass Congress and then exert pressure to improve it later? Or would it be better to allow Obama's efforts this year to fail and start over again next year?
Yeah, it's a very tough question. We would like to see a single-payer plan pass. And what we think would be one of the strongest arguments for that would be to ask the Congressional Budget Office at this point, okay, these plans have been proposed. Please analyze them from the perspective not only of their cost to the federal government, but to their total costs and to their prospects for cost control in the future. And then let's look at what we have on the table. Let's look at single payer. Let's look at the proposals proposed by Congress in the Senate and in the House and say, all right, which is most reasonable, which makes most sense? We don't want to delay health care reform, but we don't want to have a health care reform that's just going to make the system worse and allow more people to go medically bankrupt or be uninsured. There's a demonstration planned on July 30th in Washington, which is Medicare's 45th anniversary, to encourage people to pass Medicare for All, and we hope to get a good turnout for that. So I would ask everyone to be active in pushing for the kind of health care reform that's going to be meaningful to all of us.
That was Dr. Mary O'Brien, a spokesperson with Physicians for a National Health Program. Contact the group by calling area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at pnhp.org. As some Wall Street firms announce post-taxpayer bailout record profits, there's a tiny bit of good news at the other end of the economic spectrum. On July 24th, the third and final increase in a three-tier federal minimum wage law goes into effect, raising wages for the lowest paid workers covered under the law from $6.55 an hour to $7.25. The first increase in 10 years sent the minimum wage from $5.15 to $5.85 in 2007. Even though the latest increase means an additional $1,400 a year for full-time workers, their new salary totals just over $15,000 annually. Not really enough for one person to live on, much less a family. The minimum wage, instituted during the Great Depression, mandated a national base pay for all workers. However, during the intervening years, wage earners have suffered a dramatic decrease in buying power that exacerbates the financial crisis many working families find themselves in during the nation's current severe recession. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Holly Sklar, senior policy advisor for the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign. She explains that the campaign's goal is not just incremental increases in the minimum wage, but a real living wage equal to what workers earned 50 years ago, adjusted for inflation.
The minimum wage really does set the wage floor. And when the federal minimum wage is stuck at a poverty wage, it's basically allowing employers, sending a real green light for employers to pay poverty wages to a growing share of the workforce, like we've been seeing. And so the minimum wage is not just about minimum wage workers, but it's about setting the floor under all workers, setting the floor under our economy as a whole, making for a strong foundation. If you adjust for inflation, this minimum wage increase that we're going to have, the 7.25 rate starting July 24th, is still lower than a minimum wage worker earned in 1956 if you adjust for the cost of living. They earned $7.86. So we haven't even caught up back to 1956, much less back to 1968. And 1968 was the high point of the buying power of the minimum wage. So again, adjusting for inflation, it would take $9.83 in today's dollars just to match the buying power of the minimum wage of 1968. And I always think it's important to point out that 1968 is the year that Martin Luther King was killed, fighting for living wages for sanitation workers in Memphis and fighting for living wages for all workers. And the minimum wage of 1968 was much higher than the one today.
Well, business has always fought an increase in the minimum wage. You know, obviously, in a way, it's in their self-interest. But they don't present it that way. They present it as something that would inhibit job growth. Can you respond to that?
Sure. First of all, most businesses haven't always fought it. Many businesses fight it, and in particular, certain business lobbies, like the Chamber of Commerce, fight it. On the other hand, the U.S. Women's Chamber of Commerce, to take an important example, was very much for raising the minimum wage. And so that's part of the problem here, that it's been kind of a, you know, a dominance by the lobbies that have tried to, you know, they always say, oh, we can't raise the minimum wage now because the economy's bad. But then when the economy's good, they say we can't raise it now because that'll make the economy bad. The reality is they don't want a minimum wage at all. You know, if they had their way, it would be abolished. The kind of the parallel I like to use is the, you know, the Roosevelt administration when they were trying to get out of the Depression, because that's when the minimum wage was first enacted. It was enacted during the Great Depression. Now we're in the second worst crisis, we're in the worst crisis, actually, since the Great Depression. So the minimum wage was enacted during the Depression because they understood not only did they want to try and put a floor under workers to try and assure workers a fair day pay for a fair day's work, but they also understood that one of the reasons we were in the Depression was because there wasn't enough consumer buying power, enough consumer purchasing power. And so they wanted to raise wages to increase consumer purchasing power, which in turn would stimulate more business and would help the economy recover. Roosevelt called the minimum wage an essential part of economic recovery.
Holly Sklar, this Let Justice Roll living wage campaign, it goes beyond the latest increase in the federal minimum wage, as important as that is. Do you have a dollar amount in mind, or what's your next step?
We have a very concrete next step. We believe that, you know, the decade between 1997 and 2007, when the minimum wage was not raised by Congress, that was the longest period in history without a minimum wage increase. In the 1980s, we had the second longest period without an increase. So we've really had these too little, too late raises. And so in order to break this cycle of too little, too late raises, we want a more significant next step. And so we're calling for $10 in 2010 in terms of the federal minimum wage. That's our next ask, $10 in 2010. That will make up the ground lost since 1968. And that will then put us on the road to be able to bring the minimum wage to a living wage. 10 and 2010 is not going to do that at one, you know, fell swoop, but 10 and 2010 is a reasonable next step. It's affordable for business. The economy needs it. And it's going to, again, make up the ground loss and put us back on the road to bring the minimum wage to a living wage.
That was Holly Sklar of the Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign. Contact the campaign by calling area code 617-522-2923 or visit their website at letjusticeroll.org. According to news reports, President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder is considering the appointment of a criminal prosecutor to investigate Bush administration officials who authorized the torture and abuse of U.S.-held detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and secret CIA jails. A growing body of evidence exposing American torture includes the Obama administration's release of memos written by Bush administration lawyers authorizing torture and a 2007 International Committee of the Red Cross confidential report documenting interrogation abuse at U.S. CIA-run secret prisons. The report condemned America's treatment of 14 high-value terrorist suspect detainees held at secret black sites as torture and inhuman, violating U.S. and international law. Despite President Obama's inclination to look forward rather than backward with regard to the Bush administration's torture program, many human rights groups support an investigation and prosecution of government officials who were complicit in ordering torture of American-held prisoners. Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth said, "The United States can't truly claim to have repudiated these egregious human rights violations unless it returns to the day when it treated them as crimes rather than as policy options." Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Christopher H. Pyle, professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College and a former U.S. Army intelligence officer that helped expose and end the U.S. military's domestic surveillance program in 1970. Pyle, author of a new book titled Getting Away with Torture, Secret Government, War Crimes, and the Rule of Law, discusses the choices facing Attorney General Holder and the nation on prosecuting torture.
The first indication that I had that the administration was planning torture occurred on November 13, 2001, when I read in the New York Times the president's military order creating military commissions. And buried in that order was a provision that said that these new courts, created by the president alone, only to try foreign terrorists, were permitted to ignore the traditional rules of evidence. Now, there's only one reason why you would ignore the traditional rules of evidence. And that is because you want to admit evidence obtained by torture or obtained from people who are not present to testify against the accused. In other words, hearsay, rumor, what have you. Well, that was the first indication. The second indication came on February 7, 2002, when the president announced that the troops did not have to follow the Geneva Conventions on land warfare when dealing with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. When you unleash your military from having to follow the laws of war, you unleash a terrible retribution. We pioneered the rules of land warfare to control our own troops as well as to protect our troops should they be captured by our enemies. And George W. Bush just waved those treaties aside as if he had that legal authority. He did not. The Supreme Court eventually reversed him. He unleashed the military to do all sorts of things to prisoners with the full knowledge that they would not be prosecuted. And, of course, only a few of them been prosecuted, and those that were prosecuted essentially were convicted for having photographed what they were doing. That was their great offense. People who really got in trouble were the people who were photographed or photographed the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib. The superiors went free, and they went free because of a massive cover-up orchestrated from the Pentagon down. And that was necessary because Secretary Rumsfeld was giving orders directly to the colonel in charge of interrogations at Abu Ghraib.
Christopher Pyle, President Barack Obama's famous since taking office that he wants to look forward and not backward as an answer to those critics who want Bush administration officials held accountable for breaking the law. We have some indications recently that Eric Holder, President Obama's attorney general, may be considering appointing a special prosecutor to investigate U.S. officials who authorized torture. What kind of investigation would you advise Attorney General Holder to conduct if he was to take that step?
Well, I would advise the Attorney General to appoint a special prosecutor, probably a distinguished Republican lawyer, and give him carte blanche to investigate the policy of torture. That's essential if we are to restore the rule of law in the United States. Now, President Obama made a terrible mistake when he took Leon Panetta's advice. Leon's the director of the CIA, to reassure CIA agents they would not be prosecuted if they followed the Justice Department's legal memoranda when doing the torture. Holder is now in a very difficult position because it is his job, his sworn duty, to enforce the criminal law. I don't think he wants to end up to be as discredited as his Republican predecessors. On the other hand, he's got a big political problem with his administration, which has a lot of other extremely important priorities. They don't want prosecutions to disrupt the efforts to pass a health care policy. I can see that, but I see that more as a matter of timing. The point is you need a special prosecutor to undertake an investigation. The investigation will take at least a year, even with a big staff, and it's time to get on it because we need to reclaim the reputation of this nation, our own self-respect as well as the respect of other nations. And there's no way to do that unless we hold our own political criminals accountable for their crimes. And the Bush administration was full of people who were part of a major criminal conspiracy to commit felonies of the worst kind.
We hear a lot of polls and a lot of chatter out there since this debate on torture has come to light in the United States. People, it seems, maybe are influenced by TV shows that promote and glamorize torture, like the show 24. And there's a lot of concern about terrorism and a lot of spirit of revenge for what took place on September 11, 2001. But where do you think the public stands on torture and holding to account Bush administration officials who tortured many people held by this country, many of them completely innocent of whatever allegations were made against them?
If there's another terrorist attack, the public will want torture, and there'll be a slight majority in favor of it. If there's no attack and the country feels secure, then we're more likely to go back to traditional law enforcement. The real question should be, would you release the entire military and our secret intelligence agencies from any obligation to obey the criminal law? Would you let them kidnap people out of the United States? Would you let them create secret prisons for the CIA in 8 foreign countries? And most people would answer those questions. No, I don't think that would be a good idea. That's giving them too much power. The founders understood all this, but we've slipped away from that tradition, that heritage.
That was Christopher H. Pyle, professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College. Pyle is the author of the new book, Getting Away with Torture, Secret Government, War Crimes, and the Rule of Law. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at vtlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tah. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.